Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, Joe Biden said we're going to have enough vaccine by, well, I guess, the end of May for every American adult in this country, 300 million doses. And then the question is, you know, how fast can we get it into people? How fast can we get it distributed? How fast can we get people to line up and go through the process and get us to the other side of this? Because as we were talking about in the last segment, we can't get back to normal, or whatever that used to be, until we get through this pandemic and get people vaccinated, herd immunity and all of that stuff. But here's the thing. I think one of the things that we did, I hope we figured out because of this pandemic, is that we need to make stuff. We need to build stuff. We need to have access to building stuff because, well, we don't have the supply chain we used to. And global supply chains, we were told, were impenetrable. Well, they've kind of broken down for us. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how we deal with this and what President Joe Biden has declared today. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you tonight. And that is indeed good news about the vaccine. But obviously, we have a lot of work to do to get there from the public health perspective, but also from rebuilding our capacity to make things here. You bet.
Now, Joe Biden has signed an executive order that, you know, says that we're going to eliminate the supply chain weaknesses that we've had. Obviously, if we can't get the masks we need, if we can't get the personal protective equipment we need, like gowns or gloves or any of that stuff, I would say that's a pretty big deal and something that needs to be addressed right quick.
It's a huge deal, and we've seen a lot of headlines about that and on the business pages about the semiconductor shortage as well. And it is truly concerning because we still, fully a year into this, don't have enough of a domestic capacity to scale up N95 respirator masks for healthcare personnel, much less the general public. 300 plus million Americans. So we need to get there. With respect to semiconductors, we simply don't produce enough in the United States. And, you know, this is a technology that we were on the forefront of developing and perfecting and built some of the greatest companies in the world. But unfortunately, so much of that production shifted to Asia. And we're seeing, as a result of this semiconductor shortage, plant shutdowns or shift eliminations in auto assembly plants around the United States, because it's not only steel tires, glass, you know, that goes into an automobile. There's a lot of sophisticated electronic equipment as well. And we've discovered along the way in preparing this vaccine that we don't have a great supply chain for active pharmaceutical ingredients that you need to make vaccines and other types of therapeutics or antibiotics, for instance, or the means to deliver them, the glass vials and all of that. And so one of the things that I'm really happy to see, and, you know, executive orders sound, I guess they can sound ridiculous to some people. I think when Trump did them, you know, he did them with a big flourish. But I think in this case, Biden is not, there's no flourish about this. This is about substance. This is meaty. This is about finding a way to identify exactly how short we are in our production capacity in some of these critical areas, and then to develop policies to remediate that, whether it's through guaranteeing markets through domestic procurement, or building up research and development or workforce, or providing reshoring incentives, or leveling the playing field on trade, or whatever we need to be doing. And so it's everything from lithium, which goes into our high-capacity storage batteries, which will be used in electric vehicles, to, as I mentioned, vaccine production. And I'm excited that Biden has launched this. There'll be 100 days where they'll look at some of these very critical and urgent needs, and then a broader year-long review for things like the defense industrial base, which we've been talking about for, you know, almost a decade at the Alliance for American Manufacturing about how important it is and how vulnerable it is as well. And the important thing is the policy that we get at the end of this. And I do believe that what I've heard so far from the administration from the nominees that have been confirmed and from the cabinet secretaries as well, is that there is a commitment in the administration to revitalize and strengthen manufacturing, that it's not merely kind of a campaign talking point, but I think they realize that it's very central to their strategy to have an equitable recovery and to rebuild the middle class in this country, right?
Yeah, no, I look at this and look, I didn't see the big signing ceremony in the Rose Garden. I didn't see any parades. I didn't see any big events. And again, this is the difference between President Biden and the former president, that this was just getting work done. And I look at this executive order and I got a question. Why wasn't this already done before? This is something that should have been done at least 6 months to 9 months ago, maybe even a year ago, as we were entering into this. We should have been examining our supply chains, examining what we had and what we didn't have, and begin to prepare us for what was coming. We didn't have those people at the wheel at the time.
Yeah, it's been disappointing. And I will say, you know, we commissioned reports in 2012 and 2013 on vulnerabilities in our supply chains. We had a retired brigadier general do one on the defense industrial base and looked at like almost 20 different types of specific materials, everything from titanium and other sorts of specialty metals to things like advanced batteries. And we also had former governor, former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge do a report on Homeland Security concerns, things like our electrical grid, for instance, which has come into new focus now. We gave these reports to the Obama administration. We gave them to the Trump administration. We got a lot of interested nods and affirmations, but you know, very little policy change. And Trump's approach, Rick, as we both know, was to just try a big aggressive tariff approach. And as you know, I'm not afraid of tariffs. In fact, I think they should be applied, and I supported the president's actions. But there was just no strategy on the back end of that to support it through other ways, through other policy support, to actually bring those jobs back. And so it certainly disrupted trade, but it didn't have the intended effect of bringing supply chains back. So I do think that this will be a much more holistic, a much more strategic approach. But there will be some tough decisions that have to be made along the way, things like Wall Street influence, tariffs, other questions like that, that will certainly impact our ability to be competitive and to reshore some of this work from China and other countries.
Yeah. So is this the end of global trade then? I mean, the whole neoliberal era of global trade, which is we don't actually trade things. We simply buy things that were made here that are just made somewhere else. I don't think that's trade. I think that's just buying stuff we used to make from somebody else. When I think of trade, I go, hey, Scott, I got this. You got that. Let's trade something. We're just buying stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there are I think there are perfectly good reasons to support many aspects of globalization. I think that it is it can be good with the right set of rules. And so I don't believe in a fortress America. I don't know that it's even possible for us to be self-reliant on everything, nor necessarily desirable. And trade does build some of those connections. But what's been missing, Rick, is the security aspect and the aspect of how working people fare in all of this and how there has to be some balance. And the fact that you saw plants leaving in the United States that were perfectly profitable, the workers were highly efficient, highly productive, the companies were making money. They're like, you know what? We can make even more money if we exploit labor and the environment in another country. The trade rules allow us to do that. So let's go do it. And that sort of thinking is the wrong thinking. And that's what we have to put behind us. We need a trade policy that's going to put workers at the center of the focus rather than leaving them behind.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, you go back to, high school economics or Econ 101. With the rice and beans, if one country makes all the rice and one makes all the beans, eventually one country has all the rice and one country has all the beans. That's not a good scenario either. And that's what I think we're getting into, that we've allowed most of our manufacturing, especially the low-level manufacturing, to go away. And it's left us really vulnerable, not just on getting things that we need, but vulnerable for the jobs that people with those skills once held that aren't there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And what we've discovered as we've embarked on this kind of experiment of unfettered free trade with a lot of corporate rights, particularly in developing markets, is that there certainly have been benefits to shareholders. There have been benefits to big multinational companies. They've made gobs of money. But what has happened at the same time is working people are in by many measures worse off. And we have fewer manufacturing jobs, and we've made ourselves vulnerable from a homeland, national, and economic security perspective through these deficiencies. We've seen a lot of environmental exploitation, and that's not a system that certainly doesn't comport with the values that the Biden team has been professing, or with their goals to achieve a more equitable, more just economy, and one that has broadly shared prosperity. And so we do need different rules. And I'm all for trade under that different set of rules. I think they certainly can be beneficial. And it would be great to build up middle classes in other countries that would buy our products made by union workers here. But that's not the system we have right now. And so we need to get there. I don't know that it can happen overnight. But I do see a different line of thinking coming from this administration, one that is very pleasantly surprising, and one that is a major departure from not only Trump, but also Obama, Clinton, and Bush.
Absolutely. And since you brought that up, I gotta bring up Biden's Sunday, 2-minute clip on joining unions and the right of workers to organize, which, I'll be honest, day one, when he fired Peter Robb and Alice Stock, I think her name was, when he fired them, that I go, wow, that's the most any president's done in my lifetime to help labor. But now he's come out with this video, and I gotta be honest, this is a message that I have never heard from a U.S. president who was a sitting U.S. president. Obama, as a campaigner, he talked a lot about unions, talked a lot about putting on the comfortable shoes and walking the line, never so much as president. For me, Joe Biden coming out and saying that, huge moment.
Yeah, I think it shows his authentic belief in workers' rights. And the ability to choose to join a union. And I also see that reflected in many of his appointments, whether they're at the cabinet level or within the agencies. And Rick, I can't tell you the number of folks who I see headed to the Labor Department or to the U.S. Trade Representative's office or to other agencies who have a background of working with working people. Marty Walsh as Secretary of Labor, for instance. That to me speaks volumes, because I know just our experience and my experience both, working for one of the progressive labor Democrats on Capitol Hill in the 90s, David Bonnier, and also with AAM here with the steelworkers, is that, yeah, you can get your voice heard in a Democratic administration, but ultimately they had their minds made up about what they were going to do. And more often than not, on issues like this, they were siding with Wall Street. And so no doubt we will have those battles and they will be fought out. But I do feel like the Biden committed to have a seat at the table for workers and for working people. And so far, he's met that promise. He's fulfilled it.
No, and that's great. But the question then becomes is, now when you're talking about this global situation, dealing with China and, the fact that they're literally using slave labor, how do you compete with that? Well, we're talking about, we want people to have family sustained wages. We want them to have, health security, retirement security, safe working conditions. How do you compete then with a country that is literally using slave labor?
Yeah, and I'm going to, this will sound like a tangent, but I'll get to the point. One decision that did concern me was the Biden administration's reaction to the killing of Khashoggi, and in Saudi Arabia, or by Saudi Arabia, and MBS, and They acknowledge that he did it, but there appears to be, not a huge amount of sanction involved in this. And so, if we're going to have workers' rights or human rights or democratic ideals central to our economic policy, our trade policy, there will have to be some of those decisions made about imposing sanctions or tariffs or other sorts of penalties. And I think it's like that with, slave labor, prison labor, forced labor, exploited labor, child labor, all of which we know exists in China today. And how bold are those steps going to be to push back on that? We've seen the Trump administration put broad tariffs on for kind of very general reasons, but then striking a deal with China on trade that was very much reflected deals that we've had in the past, and a deal that isn't going to be lived up to. So Biden has to chart a new path here.
Overall, I'll tell you, personally, I'm happy with thus far. I mean, we're not very far into this, but so far I'm happy with the direction we've gone.
Yeah, I am as well. Much of the work remains to be done. I mean, they haven't negotiated any new trade agreements. We haven't seen the infrastructure package. We don't exactly know what the procurement policy. We don't know how the supply chain will end up, or what some of the how we're going to rewrite some of these rules. But they've laid the groundwork so that there can be success down the road. And to me, that's a good start. But now it's going to be up to all of us to do the work and to persuade them for sound reasons to do the right thing.
No, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us. But at the end of it, I'm very happy with the people that he's moved into positions. Sadly, half my Rolodex is now empty because I had a lot of people who were former guests who used to come on all the time. I go, sorry, I'm taking a job with the administration. I'm like, good for you. Go do God's work.
Well, good. And hopefully you'll get them back on the show, because I do think that they need to continue the public engagement. And that will be one of their strengths in reaching out to working class audiences and people. I think it's important to engage like that. And so the fact, as you pointed out, that the president affirmed the right to organize was pretty remarkable. And so hopefully they'll keep that up as we move ahead.
Good stuff. Scott, I appreciate the time. Appreciate the work you guys do. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Have a great one.
Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Check that out. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.